Drive-by cinema. Three nachos and a foaming thermos of fun.
Howdy, partners. Welcome to Drive-by cinema. This is season 4, episode 38. And with me, my co-host, Paul.
And with me, my co-host, Richard. Welcome, one and all.
Paul.
Yes. Oh, it sounds portentous.
Well, I do have some corrections.
Ominous. Daunting. Yeah. Dreadful. What have we stuck our foot in? Just a meringue or a blancmange, perhaps? Comical. Comical mistake.
Well, it's all about who invented the DVD, isn't it?
Oh, well, I bow down to whatever research you've done. I was looking to get a job, being a white monkey, a foreign monkey. And so I was all ears and all belief in terms of which nationality might have pride of place in claiming the DVD is their own.
Listener Pete helped to fill in some of the details.
Right. Is it an interesting story, like the karaoke machine or not?
What? The karaoke machine?
Yeah.
How is that an interesting story?
Well, one guy invented the whole thing and now it's a multi-billion dollar industry, isn't it? Very much like Caravaggio. He was James Hargreaves, the inventor of the spinning jenny. I think he died almost penniless.
Caravaggio invented what? Sorry.
I don't know. Erotic painting of a slightly nudge-nudge wing-wing variety? I don't know.
Right.
Scratch the Caravaggio, focus on Hargreaves and the spinning jenny, sorry. Because otherwise we're going to have like recursive corrections to do, aren't we?
We know that the CD was invented basically by Philips, right?
Yes, and they didn't really capitalise on it in any way. And the LD also by Philips, perhaps?
Now, you kept mentioning LDs, Paul.
I love LDs. I wish it had become a technology because I just love the size of them.
Okay, hold on a second. Because you kept mentioning LDs when we were talking about DVDs and the invention of the DVDs. And I said, that was the Japanese. And you said, oh, something about LDs. Let's just be very clear. LDs belong to a completely different branch of the tech tree.
They do, right? Yes, you're right.
What's the big difference between an LD and a CD or a DVD?
An LD is just a record player with a very small needle.
It's analog. An LD is an analog recording mechanism. Right?
Whoa. That's what I just said, isn't it?
Kind of. Suppose it is.
Explain to 5-year-olds. Yeah, if I was explaining to 5-year-olds, yeah. that would suffice.
And the LD was around since the 70s or early 80s.
Anyway, crazy. So. Amazing to think so, yeah.
It didn't hold very much because if you were watching a movie, I think it would normally come on two LDs. You'd have to get up halfway through and switch disc to see the rest of the film.
I mean, when I became a manager at karaoke, this is how I'm interested in the karaoke industry as a whole, we had to switch the LDs in 1996, 97. Yeah.
So you're saying that karaoke started with LD as their base technology?
I don't know about in Japan, because I mean, karaoke was already a very, very mature beast at that point, 97, wasn't it? It'd been going for 25 years in Japan. But in terms of mainland China, they'd been to Taiwan, they'd seen what was happening in Taiwan, and they kind of brought back the whole structure, the Taiwanese KTV structure, and tried to recreate it, kind of thing. So they were using LDs, yeah. Because, of course, you could play the video and the music at the same time.
Oh, you need the little bouncy ball on the...
Yes, I mean, that was the big thing. You know, private rooms, bouncy ball, and also a beer betting machine, which, can I just explain this, was in the corner of each of the VIP rooms we had installed, and I had to sort of pay the people to connect all the computers up. We had like PCs, yeah? They only ran one program, which was the beer betting machine.
The beer betting machine.
Yeah. So you call...
On a PC.
On a PC. So it was all connected to Ernie, who released... It was spread betting, basically. What it was you could bet on a number between 0 and 200, and the number would come up, yeah? Different beers represented the groups, like 0 to 50 was Carlsberg, 50 to 80 was, I don't know, the local beer, 80 to 120 was Heineken. I don't know why they call it beer betting, because we're in a karaoke. And then if you're number one, you win some money, of course. But that was a dedicated computer just showing the results of, every 2 minutes it would count down. And you would buy credit for your room. You call in the mama-san, give her 500 local currencies, and then that would be up on your computer screen as a virtual currency kind of thing. And that was a massive hit. We used to take thousands and thousands of dollars every night on that.
Wow, so it was like an illegal lottery happening every few minutes.
It was, yeah, that's exactly how you might imagine it, yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yeah, but the LDs, yes. So there was a little guy, you never let the Oompa Loompas out, but there's a little Oompa Loompa in the back, just taking in the orders on the computer orders, because we had another PC that took in the orders from each room, rather than previously, 10 years earlier, you'd be writing it down with a piece of pencil and giving the sub to some guy who collected the tickets. Yeah, the stubs. And then he'd be swapping and changing them, and they wouldn't always come in the order you'd order them, because obviously he had to wait until LDs were finished with by other rooms. Yeah. So he had a little guy just moving, like a little postman, picking and packing the LDs into various machines that fed into certain rooms.
Huh. Right. Okay. That's horrific. So
it is, isn't it? Yeah.
DVDs, Sony and Philips combined, improved the CD format to generate more space.
Bandwidth, so essentially.
More stuff on it. Yeah, effectively. Mm. One of the things they did was they changed the frequency of the laser beam.
Right.
And I think they also, eventually they got dual layer ones, so it could focus two different layers. So you could fit basically two discs on one. One thing that did happen, certainly in Japan and I presume in China as well, was before DVDs, there was a sort of revolution in what was called VCDs, which was like trying to cram.
That's what I meant. Very low quality. I meant VCDs. I'm really sorry. But yeah, I forgot. VCD, sorry, is it called VCD? VCD was just not a thing in the West, was it? I mean,
not really, no. No,
right,
because
it was
terrible quality. Yeah.
Yeah, it was pretty bad quality. Right.
It was very, very compressed because it didn't have the technological improvements that DVD allowed.
But maybe better than somebody recording the film with a digicam in a cinema. And there's the trade-off, you see.
Maybe, maybe. Mm. So there we go. Paul, the other thing is, mm-hmm. last week, I believe, we ended up talking a little bit about Trump. And we know where your alliances are sort of for. And you did say something about Trump.
What are you talking about? You know where my alliance is for.
You said something that he was a very effective communicator.
Not in terms of how he communicates, but in terms of the effect he has on his audience. Yeah, sure.
But I just thought we should perhaps review some of Trump's words.
Yeah, I know what you're going to say. I mean, he just repeats himself, he mumbles, and he's unclear. But it's for some reason his audience seem to like that.
Okay, well, as long as you understand precisely.
So that doesn't make me a Trump supporter, yes. Richard, you're just trying to, I don't know, you've put your hand in the muddy puddle, you're just trying to splatter it on my face now, aren't you?
I'm sure we'll end up talking a little bit more about politics and Trump when we come to the subject of this week's film.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Of course, yes.
After this music.
After this music. Bullets fly, buildings crumble, in this modern civil war. Increasingly, I have no idea what that music is going to have been.
Yeah.
I've been getting more experimental with the AI, negotiating with it for its creative output, so who knows?
What could it be?
Mm-hmm. Paul, what is this week's movie, which we went to the cinema to see?
This is 2024, Alex Garland, written and directed by Civil War.
Civil War mm-hmm. being the state that he is predicting America will be in.
I don't know, is he? Is it a prediction or is it... Is it just a dystopian fever dream?
It seems that way, isn't it? If you watch interviews with MAGA faithful, they all say, if Trump loses in November, it's going to be civil war. There's going to be an uprising. Whoa. That's what they're saying.
I remember being on YouTube about 3 or 4 years ago, and there was a really kind of gonzo-style journalist. He was a young guy, 22, 23. And he dropped out of college, and he was just going to all the peripheral, not MAGA rallies themselves, but the peripheral activities. But there's a biker culture around all this. They all turn up on their bikes and their Harleys and their attitudes from whenever they were relevant. And it was just incredible. He was just getting down with these people, partying with them kind of thing, trying to soundbite and hear what they thought about stuff, which wasn't very much. But it was just bike rallies, Harley rallies, and middle-aged women just flashing their titties kind of stuff, and just like, just so much beer. And he was just on a road trip. He bought a coach, bought an old Greyhound bus, and was just following the rallies kind of thing. So that's when I first became, what was that, like, I don't know, before lockdown, 2019 or something like that. That's when I was aware that, like, what the Tea Party had become in terms of Trumpism was something a little bit unhinged, shall we say. Here we get a vision of an America that is completely unhinged, isn't it? I mean,
the opening of Civil War is a president rehearsing a speech he's about to give, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's played by Nick Offerman from Parks and Rec. He's our president. He's going over in his head what he's about to say, and it's basically him suggesting that they've nearly prevailed in this war against the secessionists.
Which we know is fake news, or planned fake news, yeah? Eventually.
Well, he is trying to convince himself, isn't he, to sound convincing. He's repeating it, trying to sound more bombastic. So it seems that he's rehearsing himself into that
state. He does eventually rise on a crescendo kind of confidence, doesn't he? Yeah.
So we're learning very early on in this film that what's happening is that two states, Texas and California, have...
Strange bedfellows, but there we go.
They have secessionist kind of ambitions. They're combined into what's called the Western Forces. And they're advancing eastward toward Washington, where kind of the original U.S. government and military are trying to hold off this encroaching force.
The Western Forces have a U.S. flag, but with two lone stars.
Two stars, kind of, yeah. Already, there's quite a lot to unpack here. As you say, Texas and California do seem like strange bedfellows. Texas, though, always seems to have maintained quite a secessionist kind of stance, doesn't it?
Oh, very it much seems, so, yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
The Lone Very Star much like States. Cornwall in the United Kingdom.
Yeah, I'm not really allied with a Confederacy as such, I don't think. Although there is some sort of use of the Confederate flag, I think, to represent those secessionist views. But yeah, I think it's just the idea that Texas should be independent, its own independent state. Yeah.
Now, my understanding of American history and politics is not that good. But I get the feeling, if my vague understanding is right, that the way different states incorporate themselves into the United States, we were on different terms, potentially.
I think so, yeah. That's interesting.
So it's possible that there are different circumstances under which states might be able to secede, according to their original sort of union, act of union stuff. California, of course, is sometimes
mentioned...
Are you
telling me they just can't vote out?
I don't know. I expect probably there is some state-related legal structure to try and do that.
Oh, right.
California, of course, is often mentioned in terms of secession plans because it is far and away the biggest economy in the states, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. It would, I think, be the 10th or the 8th biggest economy, something like that, the 8th or 10th biggest economy in the world.
So of all the states, if it wanted to, it could certainly stand on its own. There's no doubt about California. And I suppose putting California and Texas together is it's sort of plausible, isn't it, that they could stand against the rest of the US?
It is plausible, yeah. Okay. So what's nice here is, I mean, it's kind of left quite smudgy and out of focus, like, what the political stances are of the original United States and the Western Front, is it?
Oh, yeah. We know absolutely nothing about the different policies and stuff.
No, we don't. I mean, it's left deliberately blurred, isn't it?
It's very impressionistic, which I think is in of itself a commentary about something about the futility of civil war and stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you consider news reports of civil wars in different countries, quite often it's African countries that are engaged in ongoing civil wars and have been for many years. But we don't get any idea, do we, about the different factions. We just hear the word civil war.
It is almost irrelevant from an outside perspective, isn't it?
So I think almost any civil war is going to seem pointless and irrelevant to outsiders.
I mean, Jamaica was almost, it had civil unrest, didn't it, whilst Bob Marley was rising in fame. And he got dragged to one side of the factions. So there were political parties, which were legitimate political parties, there was a legitimate democracy. Somehow the parties had got a groundswell of support from local gangs to the extent that they became allied with high-ranking drug dealers, kind of thing, and Bob Marley got on the wrong side of one of these groups, and was almost an assassination attempt on him at some point. So yeah, civil war can grip any country at pretty much any time, guy. It's hard to predict, isn't it, when it could happen, or are there some key indicators?
Can I be really finicky here as well, though, and suggest that a war of secession, I don't think, is really a civil war. It's strictly territorial, right? I mean, the United States is a union of different states. You could consider it a collection of different nations working together. So if some states want to secede, I don't think that's really a civil war, right?
But in not being allowed to secede, therefore they had to take over the capital and take down Washington. Does that make sense? So did it not become civil war in that sense?
Like the original civil war, which is more about the emancipation of slaves and ideological differences between... Obviously, it ended up being North and South.
Yeah.
It ended up being expressed geographically. But I suppose, again, we don't know the real ideological reasons behind this secession attempt, do we? But I take your point. I think if you look very carefully at the world Alex Garland is painting here. They do mention at one point that it's not just the Western forces, Texas and California.
No, they do. Yeah, there's probably some Canadians too.
No, there's Floridians. The Northeastern are in one group. And then, as you say, the Floridians and the states around Florida wind up in another group. And then there's this belt across the middle of the US to the Northeastern, New York, Washington, D.C. and stuff. Yeah, the implication one of the journalists made was that once the Western forces defeat the president, then it's going to be, everyone will be fighting one another.
So what we don't get here is a view of civil war or unrest, civil unrest, from the perspective of the combatants, do we? We get this in the sense of a travelogue of reporting photographers.
It's a road movie.
It's a road movie, isn't it?
And it's a movie about war journalism and war photography more than
yes.
anything.
Yes.
As soon as we've flicked away from the president about to give his address, we switch to the main character, Lee.
Played by Kirsten Dunst.
Played by Kirsten Dunst. Amazingly well, actually. And she's on her way with her buddy, Joel, and they are going to a sort of flashpoint event happening somewhere in New York City.
Yeah. Okay, so there's some sort of insurrectionary activity in New York, even.
What's happening is they go to a place where water is being distributed, like rationed from a big Bowser. And there's civil unrest because obviously lots of people need water. She's watching the ordinary people being rather unruly and the police trying to defend the Bowser and stuff, and fights start breaking out. And at one point, another photojournalist, a young girl,
Jessie Cullen,
she gets hit in the face, doesn't she, by one of the policemen, or in a scuffle, accidentally perhaps. Lee kind of looks after her and takes care of her and tells her to get down and watch out for herself and put on a high-vis press vest so she doesn't get hit in the face again.
And then there's a suicide bombing.
That's right, yeah. Then suddenly, without warning, well, Lee kind of spots it happening, doesn't she?
Yeah, because of her experience, etc., etc.
So she throws Jessie to the ground and protects her. As you say, a suicide bomber runs into the crowd and blows themselves up. And Lee takes some pictures of it. Then we get a scene in a hotel somewhere in New York where all of the press have gathered, which I guess is what happens in all of these war areas. You hear about them being in the hotel, don't you, with the other journalists? Mm-hmm. And they're all talking shop about where they're going to go and what they're trying to cover, the kind of stuff that's been happening.
This is very evocative. I guess if you're a reporter in a war zone, you all hunker down in one of the best hotels in town under the chandeliers and get drunk and exchange stories, don't you? So this was a nice kind of lull before the action, the horror of the movie begins, I guess, isn't it?
The power goes out at one point. Lee is about to sort of go up to her room and she was going to get in the elevator, but it's on the 10th floor. And the reception guy says, well, you don't want to go in the lift because we might have a power cut and you'll be stuck. So, yeah, she's contemplating a 10-story walk up the stairs to get to her room in this posh hotel.
Trying to fob off Jessie, the girl that she's befriended temporarily earlier in the day, who's kind of a bit clingy, isn't she? She's kind of hanging around.
She's fangirling, right? She knows she is Lee is a famous war journalist, photographer, photojournalist. She's trying to get on her good side and get advice from her. And it transpires when Lee wakes up and goes to see Joel in the van the next morning that she's managed to inveigle her way onto their car because she must have spoken to Joel or something. And they're also taking along Sammy, who's like the old hand who's near retirement, isn't he? They were talking with him the night before about what their plans were. Apparently Joel and Lee plan to go and try and get an interview with the president.
Because they know, despite his press releases, that he's going down, basically. And they want to get the last interview with him before he's killed, basically, I think, is the idea, isn't it? They know it's not going to end nice for him.
We've heard a couple of things that he's done, which I suppose are part of the reason why there's an uprising against him.
I wasn't aware.
Well, Sammy mentions, I think, questions that you might ask him are, how did you feel about your third term? And why did you dissolve the FBI or whatever?
Third term implying he shouldn't have a third term, according to the original statutes of the United States.
Yeah, Americans are very keen on their presidents only having two terms. Mm. And it seems to be the hallmark of authoritarianism and tyranny, doesn't it? To have a third term. I mean, clearly it is true that tyrants and despots do wind up being perpetually voted in. Mm. Like, I mean, Putin must have been delighted, mustn't he, at the results of the election. I mean, he must have a real sense of achievement when he gets voted in each time. It must make the whole exercise of going through an election sound really worthwhile to him. It's sort of a strange peccadillo to have, isn't it?
Well, not as strange as the House of Lords, where up until recently there was not just a lack of term limits, but you could inherit the term from your parents, kind of thing.
Listen, I'm not going to defend the House of Lords.
Good. Clearly, but we do need an upper house, so I think the idea of abolish the upper house, I think, is a bad idea, because many people are mooting that, aren't they?
It should be elected or nominated. There may be a way
elected
of
upper house,
fairly nominating an upper house, but it should be people with expertise, right? People who have demonstrated experience and expertise in fields. You shouldn't just be allowed to nominate whoever you like as Prime Minister, put in whatever that Russian oligarch guy was.
Well, there we go.
Kleptocratic guy. Or just your mates, because you promised them that you would. Anyhow, yeah, so we know that this president has had a third term, and he's presumably got rid of the FBI for some reason to do with perhaps covering up his own misdeeds, I don't know. Because we've seen what happens if you let law and order loose on your president, haven't we, in the last few days?
I haven't been following the court case, Richard.
You haven't, so you don't know that he's been falling asleep during the court cases and his jury selection.
As a Trump supporter, Richard, I can't. It's just too painful for me, isn't it?
Too painful for you to watch. Listen, I'm sure going through the early phases of this trial, jury selection, for instance, is going to be...
That's a genuine issue, isn't it? I mean, because there are people self-immolating.
Yeah, but weirdly, that guy wasn't pro or anti-Trump. He was like...
he was just disturbed, yeah. Well...
He was anti both Trump and Biden.
Horrible for his family to have to go through, but yeah, he was very disturbed, wasn't he? Oh.
The jury selection, I think, has been really eye-opening the way that they've done it.
Is it loaded dice or not, do you think?
No, I think it's very sensible and very, very rational the way they've approached it.
But they've excluded people with what you might argue are quite rational opinions about Trump because they don't like him.
Let's put it this way. If you were thinking you would have to get total clean skins, people who'd never heard of Trump, that's obviously crazy. Mm-hmm. Impossible, yeah. And it's not the case, obviously, that you have to have someone who doesn't know anything about someone to get a fair trial. What the judge did at the start, straight away he asked everybody who here thinks they can't judge this case fairly.
Wow, Likert scale. It's a good start, yeah.
About half the people put their hand up and said, no, I can't. Now, a lot of people like to get out of jury duty, right? Because...
Of course, yeah, yeah.
It's going to be 6 or 8 weeks trial.
And you don't get paid for it, yeah.
You might get some compensation.
In the US,
I don't know. You don't get paid full wage, certainly. Mm. But particularly in a high-profile case against someone like Trump, there might be all kinds of repercussions of being a juror. People are inclined to want to get out of jury service. I think there's an aphorism that you hear lawyers talk about in the States, which is, you know, the last thing you want is to go up against 12 people who are too stupid to get out of jury duty. But there is obviously a civic duty thing behind it all as well. And you can understand why people might...
Well, I can imagine, you know, given who he is, I imagine it's pricked some sort of civic responsibility in some of the applicants or some of the candidates.
The other side of it is the jury, although they are anonymous, they're not publicly known, the defence and the prosecution legal teams do know who they are. And they research their social media histories.
That's what's been coming up, right, okay.
If you see someone who's clearly a MAGA supporter, or on the other side, someone who's a very liberal kind of anti-Trump, you clearly are going to raise that as an issue. And you can dismiss as many jurors as you like if you've got good cause to do so. Yeah, people waving MAGA flags and wearing caps and stuff, they're straight out, as are people who are clearly strongly on the left as well. And then there's a series of questions that you can put to the jurors about whether or not they think they can judge the case fairly. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it boils down to, really, is whatever your political opinions and whatever you may think of Trump, are you prepared to leave that to one side and make a judgment about the law in this case? I think it's been quite enlightening.
You're saying he's fallen asleep. Wasn't he glaring at people before? Now
he was told off for trying to intimidate the jury. Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Trump's legal team are obviously now going to say that the jury is rigged and it's hopeless. New York is like 85% Biden voting. It's true. But the defense team ended the jury selection, and I think they still had some of their like jokers left over. So they have accepted the jury every bit as much as the prosecution have. The jury has been chosen fairly, and they were part of that process. It's very difficult, I think, for them to claim that the jury is biased against them. They've had every opportunity to question the jury and make the selection.
Now, I haven't been following the trial, but what I have been listening to is the possibility that Trump might become president from inside jail. Which, there's nothing on statute book stopping that happening, by the way.
Great. Lovely. If he's going to go to jail, it'll be because of this. And he could go to jail as a consequence of him breaking his gag order, as he calls it, which is really just instructions not to threaten the family members of the people involved in the court case.
So I'm not laughing because of what he's done. It's almost unbelievable, isn't it?
The interesting thing is, he is apparently falling asleep. I don't actually blame him for that, because I'm sure it's pretty boring for him. But I would say that if you've spent 18 months of your political campaign calling your opponent Sleepy Joe, it's a bad look to then fall asleep in front of the world's press. But secondly, apparently he's not only been falling asleep, he's also been farting with such odious guffs that his own defence lawyers who are sitting next to him can barely stand being near him.
Okay. Have you ever fallen asleep in a meeting, Richard? Has it ever happened to you? It has to me several times.
I mean, sometimes you're working very hard and... Yeah.
And you have those micro naps, but you never, when you wake up again, you're never quite sure how long you've been out for. Does that happen to you?
Micro naps, they're really terrifying, aren't they? Yeah. It's an unpleasant experience.
Anyway, back to the movie. So we get a road movie, haven't we? And we get a countdown of how many kilometres it is to their destination, ultimate destination, Washington. So essentially, we're going to go from the States, from New York down to...
It's about 1,000 miles anyway, isn't it?
It is. Got to go. So you think what? 4 days, given the state of the roads and whatnot. Okay. So what kind of things are we going to come across here? Are we going to get like a local yokel Woody Harrelson guy at a gas station, maybe, who's going to be difficult to read?
Let's just recap. There's four of them. There's Lee,
yeah,
the very experienced war photojournalist. Joel, the journalist who's desperate to get
from Reuters
a quote,
and from Florida,
a quote from the president. There's the brand new Green photojournalist, yeah, Jesse. And there's the real old hand about to retire, Sammy.
Sammy, yeah.
Who is... He's a bag of instincts about what is a good idea and what isn't. He's not planning to go with them to DC.
He says
that journalists get shot on sight in DC. So he's planning to get as far as the front line, which is somewhere outside DC at that point. Jesse is tagging along, but Lee is insisting that she's also not going to go with them to DC. They're going to drop her off.
That point, I think.
But the first thing that happens when they get on the road outside of New York is they find... As soon as they go through like a checkpoint, they wind up seeing a gas station. Sammy says, oh, you should get fuel whenever you can.
This is after they've had to cross the highway because there's so many abandoned vehicles at one point, yeah?
Yeah. So they stop at this gas station and it's sort of staffed by three guys, like survivalists with assault rifles, sitting outside watching them warily. Lee negotiates to pay. First they ask him if they've got a fuel permit. She offers him $300.
And they're like, $300? Are you joking? I'll buy you a sandwich, maybe.
And then she says, Canadian. And then they're like, oh, okay, then. Sure.
An economy that's still working. So, yeah, so they get to fill up the tank and two cans. Is that right?
But Jessie has wandered off and
she's found... She spotted something around Burke, hasn't she?
Her photojournalist eye saw something as they were driving up. And she finds, round the back of the gas station, there's
the
one
wash,
of those,
yeah,
car washes. And what's in it?
Well, it's two... Barely alive captives, strung up and bleeding to death from their guts, I think.
Yeah, one of the gas station guys says that they were looters.
He says, I used to know this guy in school. Never talked to me much then, he's not talking much now. But it's gruesome, isn't it? I mean, it's quite a gruesome opening. We've had half an hour to kind of ease our way into this, but then it's just like a slap in the face at this point, isn't it?
Jesse takes... Well, actually, Jesse doesn't take any photographs. He's just shocked. I think Lee maybe comes up and takes some photographs and gets the guy to pose with him. And then Jessie has to reflect on what she's just seen as they get in the car and drive away. She's just beginning to understand what being a war journalist means. And I think we're beginning to understand what civil war in America means. They stop by a crashed helicopter that's in the parking lot of a retail complex with JCPenney's and stuff.
That's right.
Lee realises this is a great photo opportunity, seeing a military chopper crashed in, like, retail kind of...
Yeah, you could imagine it's about to turn into a zombie movie, couldn't you, at this
yes,
point?
Yes, exactly. She compliments Jesse on her old Nikon... Are they FE2s or something? Or old film cameras she's using?
Yeah, they're not digital cameras, are they?
These were Jesse's dad's cameras that she's using. She's doing everything old school style. But they spend the night there, don't they? And they're watching all the tracer fire overhead. Like,
very atmospheric. Atmospheric, but doubtless no fun to be in. And I'm not sure at what point does... Sorry, what's his name?
Sammy.
What does he give advice to Jesse about how to sleep?
He is, yeah.
Okay. I mean, because she's having difficulty dealing with all the adrenaline because of being in a war zone, I guess.
Next day, we go straight into the action. because they found actual military action happening. Again, we don't really get a sense of who is who here.
No, purposefully.
A constant theme throughout this film.
But we do get some very, very retro future modernistic buildings to have the fighting take place in.
It's like, kind of like a Belgrade residential complex, isn't it?
Yeah, but it looks a bit like Belgrade. I don't know how they managed to get that in the US, but there we go.
There's a load of concrete like walkways and stuff. Mm. But there's a team of guys dressed in Hawaiian shirts with assault rifles and stuff. And they're fighting some guys in some normal battle fatigues, normal urban camo stuff. The journalists are right in the action, completely embedded with this Hawaiian shirt crew. They see one guy get shot and basically dies in front of them. Eventually, the Hawaiian shirt crew prevails. They shoot one of the enemies who was wounded. They capture three other guys and put them in hoods, take them out to the field near this residential place, and just execute them whilst Jesse and Lee are taking pictures. This is proper action movie stuff, isn't it? It's incredibly loud. It was incredibly loud in my movie. Every time a gun fired, it was like being kicked in the back of the seat. They drive on, I think, and they find a refugee station that's been set up by an international NGO.
Again, inside some... Well, this is quite trippy. It's inside an abandoned stadium, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I thought this was very evocative. Like when it's a high school stadium, I don't know, I think the concerns of running a 400 meter a second faster, think about the concerns, they're just now irrelevant to that whole structure. It was built for, it's seemingly in Civil War, just really trivial things, like pushing a ball so many yards up a field. And so I thought that juxtaposition of something that was quite homely and had a very sort of defined urbane function now just being this refugee camp. Yeah, he selected his locations really well, I think, in this movie.
This whole film it showcases Garland's visual imagery, doesn't it?
Yes.
What a lot of this film is about is pulling out these scenes of war, of urban war, modern war, that we're used to from conflicts all around the world, but setting them in the US. Particularly for US audiences, but no less so, I guess, for all of us who are used to American movies and TV. Seeing all of this stuff, like, being destroyed by war is quite a shock, isn't it? It's a really evocative piece of imagery, if nothing else. They spend the night here again, and once again exchange a bit of wisdom about life. We see Jesse using a developer and stuff to develop her old-fashioned film cans.
And Lee now is really taking it under her wing, isn't she? She's really warming to the girl. Although she's still not keen on her going all the way to Washington, yeah.
She's so tough, isn't she? She's got a hard bitten exterior. Mm. And she's actually suffering from PTSD, isn't she?
Yeah.
She has flashbacks to other war situations she's been in that she's obviously not really dealt with very well. And is just carrying this around with her.
So thankfully, the action lulls for a short time the next day as we head into a town. I don't know how you describe it, like a hypertopia, yeah? Kind of a town that doesn't want to admit that it's in the middle of a civil war.
Everything seems normal, that's right, yeah. They stop, pull alongside this shop, they boutique, wind up in this, it's a boutique clothes shop, isn't it? And the girls go shopping for dresses and stuff, and trying them on and taking pictures. And when they come out, though, Sammy is saying, just... don't make it obvious you're looking, but check out the tops of the buildings. And it's really well framed, isn't it? Because it just pulls back slightly and you see the snipers like standing on the top of the buildings of this otherwise idyllic kind of East Coast American town, you know. Mm-hmm. Now, is the next bit where they find themselves driving to the country club and there's like a winter wonderland set up?
Yeah, there's been the remains of some, I don't know, Christmas fete or Christmas fair with gaudy installations like a giant glowing snowman and that kind of thing. And
it's in the grounds of this big country club style house. Yeah. And it's very open.
So again, great juxtaposition, isn't it? These things that don't mean anything anymore. They're just strewn across the landscape, discarded in terms of meaning and function. It's quite powerfully put. It was a really good choice, I thought.
But apart from a bunch of junk being on or near the road, there's also the body of a soldier lying in the road. They stop and they contemplate this and wonder whether they should turn back briefly. But Joel decides he's going to press on. He starts driving slowly. Suddenly, a bullet hits the vehicle. He steps on it and drives through and drives into a bit of cover in the middle of this kind of little installation.
And then we get like an epic shootout, don't we?
Well, they all pile out, don't they, and hit the deck, get behind the car wheels and stuff. They see these two guys as a sniper and a spotter who have embedded themselves.
Are they in Hawaiian shirts? Are they militiamen too?
They're not in Hawaiian shirts. They're in full battle fatigues. But they've got... A lot of them have... There's quite a lot of like powder paint covering stuff, isn't there? Like Mardi Gras style paint, and one guy's got, the sniper has actually got painted fingernails, like multicolored painted fingernails. But again, these are the only clues you have, even of which side anybody is on.
But Joel says, which side are you on? What are you fighting for? And they just look at him and say, you're not getting this Civil War thing. They're in there shooting at us. We're out
we're
here
shooting at them.
Shooting at them. What more is there to say? It's a war.
Who are those guys? It's a guy with a gun. You know?
Guy with a gun, you know. And they're shooting at us. Of course we're going to be shooting back. And I think this really encapsulates when war begins. It doesn't stop, does it?
Yeah, the futility, the pointlessness of it. How would you explain the difference? They think you should have to wait 21 days for a gun and we think you should only have to wait 14. And of course, you know, so this plays out with the photojournalist taking pictures of the event. And eventually the sniper pulls the trigger and says, I've got good news.
Good news. That guy, he's a great shot, whoever he is, the guy in the building, but they've taken him out, yeah. So at this point, we're learning that Jessie is improving in her photography as she experiences more trauma and death in front of her kind of thing.
They're driving along, and then I think Lee is at the wheel at this point. They see another car approaching from behind, and it's really barreling along.
So I love the way he had two classic movie tropes here. Woody Harrelson, the dodgy yokel at the gas station. Is he going to be bad? Is he going to be good? Turns out to be bad kind of thing, but played in a different way. And then in any kind of role movie,
Woody Harrelson, by the way.
I know, yeah, but that kind of character. Woody plays them very well, doesn't he? And the other thing is you're going to have guys, rednecks, turn up in a truck behind you, start hassling you on the road, yeah?
Yeah,
and he
sure
plays this really well too. He twists this one too, doesn't he? So I quite enjoyed this.
Yeah, because she notices that it's really gunning it, this car behind.
Sliding on the last corner, yeah, kind of thing.
And eventually it pulls up alongside. Sammy's going, just let him pass. Just let him go past. He pulls up alongside. Joel looks over and he realizes he knows these guys. They're more Reuters journalists. And it's a couple of Asian guys, actually.
Tony. Tony and Bohai, yeah.
One of them says, hey, I'm going to jump across your car.
Have you ever done this, Richard?
No, I've never done that.
It's the best feeling, yeah. It's the best feeling, yeah. Have you ever surfed a car?
No.
Surfed a taxi? Have you ever paid a taxi driver to surf on top of his taxi?
No, I've never done that.
Oh, seriously. I mean, like, it's dangerous, but it's, I mean, if you've done it, it's just such a rush. You know?
But whose car did you go from one car to the other, Paul? Or can you not say that for reasons of incrimination?
Yeah, I mean, it involves trust, doesn't it? But it's not that difficult, really.
He leaps across. Jessie's so excited about this, she decides she's going to go
back
the
way,
other way.
Yeah, it's cool.
She hops across. And then the guy whose car she just got in buzzes off, doesn't he?
Paul tells it, he disappears off into the dust. And Lee's got an instinct about this. As they round the next corner and they're out of sight, they're like, what the fuck? Where are these people? Jessie's in with this guy. Something's happened to them. And her instinct proves correct, doesn't it?
She nearly crashes, doesn't she, into an oncoming vehicle.
That's
like
right,
like an APC comes down the road.
Because what, she's thinking about where Jessie is, or?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway, a couple of minutes later, or in the film anyway, they discover the abandoned truck of their compatriots.
That's right. It's got both of its doors open, and there's nobody in the vehicle. There's a dwelling, there's a building off the side of the road, so Lee turns the press car up the little driveway. But they get out early and go and have a look, check out what's happening. And she uses her really long telephoto lens and she sees through it two soldiers at sort of the back of the grounds of this building.
Mm-mm.
They're leading Jessie and the Asian guy who was driving that other car. They make them kneel next to a pit that they're tending to. And there's a tipper truck full of corpses.
Civilian corpses.
And they're tipping it into
so
the
pit. I thought this was interesting. The first two we've kind of followed, it turns out to militia if you work it out, who seem to be doing great and also fighting a decent battle or a warlike battle. And now we get militia who are randomly killing the civilian population. So I kind of like the balance here, the unstructured and kind of unconscious balance that he's kind of put here, which is there aren't good or bad sides necessarily, are there, in war? I mean, there are definitely good and bad soldiers.
And this bad soldier is played by Jesse Plemons.
Ah, right.
And he's spreading quicklime on the corpses.
Crazy guy.
Lee has decided that they've got to go there. They've got to approach and help Jesse and this other guy.
Which he does with incredible aplomb and experience. I don't know if I could stay composed in that situation.
No, quite. But Sammy is absolutely beside himself saying, you're going to die. Hmm. Those guys don't want to be seen doing whatever they're doing. If you go there, we're all going to be dead. And she tells Sammy to wait here anyway because he's an old man. He won't be able to run away.
The militant is either xenophobic, racist, or both.
Yeah.
A very intimidating exchange where he's asking people, where are you from? Where are you from? Exactly.
It's a scene from the trailer, isn't it, actually? Mm. He says, and they say, we're Americans. And he says, yeah, but what kind of American are you?
Whoa.
Where are you from? Joel says he's from Florida. But Joel's like Hispanic, isn't he, clearly?
He is, yeah.
Jesse says Minnesota or something, and Lee says Colorado. And then he points to the other Asian guy.
And where are you?
Actually, he's already shot the Asian guy who was driving Jesse.
He's
just killed him. He goes to the other Asian guy, and the guy says Hong Kong, and he shoots him immediately, doesn't he, basically?
Dump full of bullet and arriving in our ears in the cinema. So, yeah, I mean, I'm glad I watched it in IMAX, but I have to say, sometimes the changes in volume were, well, I don't think I've got sensitive nerves, but it was like, well, okay, that was freaking loud.
Well, at this point, you're thinking they're all going to wind up dead, which would be a very strange way to end the film. Sammy, of course, comes driving up really quickly in the press car, knocks both of the soldiers into the pit.
I did not see that coming, and I guess they didn't either.
I think Jessie wound up in the pit as well. She had to jump out of the way, but she crawls out, they get her out, they all pile back into the car, and they flee from the one remaining soldier, I think was driving the tipper truck, jumps out and shoots at them as they go away, as they flee. Joel is in total shock. He's just seen his two writers buddies die. Jesse just vomits in the back seat. And as they're driving away, Sammy sort of turns to Lee and he says, I gotta stop. She says, no, you can't stop. We're fleeing. Why are you stopping? And he says, I'm hit. It becomes apparent one of the bullets that was shot at the car has hit him.
Now, there's a very moving scene here where, as he dies, the sights of the war at night kind of become his death visions kind of thing as he drifts off into coma kind of thing. And it would have been nice for me to watch that moving moment, but I had to go to the bathroom, so...
So you may have missed them arriving at the forward base for the Western forces.
Maybe by half a minute or so, yeah.
I mean, there's not much discussion of how they found their way there or how they knew that they were safe there and stuff. But all these Western forces have arrived with Chinooks and tanks and Humvees, and a massive force has arrived. A load of F-35s fly over the top as well, doing barrel rolls. Sammy has died, sadly. The body gets dealt with by the Western Forces guys, and they meet up with a couple of their colleagues who have been embedded in the Western Forces.
I love this competitivity, the rivalry and the camaraderie between journalists. It's quite...
Yeah, no, exactly.
It's quite cool.
But they're telling them that the plan is to move on Washington, D.C., like, straight away.
Whoa.
Joel is furious because he thinks this whole thing has been for nothing because they won't be able to get to the president before the Western Forces go and overthrow the government, effectively. I think they all wind up, don't they, embedding with the Western Forces units. Jesse and Lee and Joel end up with one of the units that goes into DC in the next scene, which is an amazing set piece, isn't it?
Well, I think we have like 25 minutes of almost continuous action now, don't we, from here on in. It's just, I mean, it's not one camera shot, but it kind of feels like that, doesn't it? It kind of feels like cutless take here, in the continuity of the action.
So the story goes that at this point, effectively, the US military have surrendered, but Washington, D.C. is a holdout, and the president and his Secret Service...
His Secret Service are going to hold out, whatever, aren't they? They're not going to give in.
It's a nighttime push on D.C. is what we see, and they go in with Abrams tanks and with Apache helicopters down the street firing rockets. There's a scene where there's a huge explosion at the Lincoln Memorial where some soldiers were holding out, and they wind up on a full frontal assault on the gates of the White House, don't they?
We're invested in our team. What keeps us watching is the fact that they're constantly, either with or without helmets, right in the middle of the action, being pulled and pushed by soldiers who are saying, keep yourself safe, guys, kind of thing.
And they're constantly jumping out to get these great shots, and you think they're going to get shot.
I like the soldiers. They're running for cover behind tanks and behind armored vehicles and that kind of stuff. So the detail of inner city warfare, I thought, was very well represented here.
They destroy the front gates. There's guards there and stuff, but they bring a tank up that blows it open. And they're seeing now the front of the White House, and they see... They're quite a way away, but they see people coming out of the White House, getting into the... They've got the Beast there, that huge limousine that's got, like, armoured glass, and a couple of Suburbans full of Secret Service come barreling out.
It will still run on its tyres, won't it, even if you shoot them, so... So, yeah.
All these three cars come out, and they manage to obviously stop them because they've actually got tanks and APCs and 50 caliber machine guns and stuff.
Lee knows it's a decoy. The president,
that's not the president, yeah.
Ain't in there. So she says, let's get to that White House. He's still in there.
Yeah, so there's a bit of a lull, isn't there, where everyone is focused on these three vehicles. No one's looking at the White House. She leads Joel and Jesse off to go and look at the White House while they all attack the Beast. Eventually, people get out, and it's obviously not the president. It's like decoys.
And they arrive in an empty hallway, don't they?
They arrive in the White House, and now the end of this movie, perhaps unrealistically, because I think there's a bunker underneath the White House.
There is, yeah, that would be difficult to get into in a matter of minutes or hours.
But the rest of this film is actually them fighting through the famous bits of the White House that presumably you can do on a tour, and the Secret Service guys with submachine guns fighting. And yeah, it's a loud, thrilling, pitched gunfight. And of course, what we're going to find is that at a critical moment, Jesse, the young photographer, jumps out, tries to take pictures to see what the action is, what action is happening.
Lee recognises the fact that she's vulnerable and prone to being shot at any moment. So
she jumps out in front of Jesse and protects her, throws her to the ground, gets shot herself.
Yeah, takes the reign of Secret Serviceman's last desperate attempt to protect his president, yeah.
And Jesse catches the moment of Lee being shot as a final moment as she falls in front of her, having saved her life. But Jesse, you know, is now like the full-on war photographer. They're now at the sort of the goal of this whole expedition, really. And they've cornered the president in the Oval Office behind the Constitution desk or whatever it's called. The Western Forces soldiers sort of drag him out. Joel says, you know, stop, wait. They've already told him that they plan to kill him.
He wants his quote, though, doesn't he? He's come for a quote.
That's right. They say it's a kill mission, not a capture mission. But he stops them from killing him straight away, and he says, a quote, Mr. President. And the president says, what does he say? What's his
Don't
last?
Let these fuckers kill me.
Don't let them kill me, yeah. Yeah. Joel says, yeah, that'll do.
That'll and do. Then photo.
They shoot him.
And then the credits roll, and we're left with presumably Jesse's photo of the team that took out the president, smiling, grinning, guns are hoisted around his corpse, yeah. Spoils of war. So you talk about Trump, and it's interesting that I think Garland's played this very well to an audience, is that if you were a MAGA supporter, you could kind of see the president as being unfairly deposed. Mm. Yeah. Except, of course, it was MAGA supporters that ran on Capitol Hill and essentially assaulted the government. So, I mean, there's plenty. I think he's pitched it in that kind of
it's ambiguous
non-partisan
pitched,
way, so that people can take the lesson about civil war without feeling that their political instincts have been betrayed.
It'd be the only way to do it, wouldn't it? Because any other way would just be seen as sort of propagandizing or partisanship.
However he did it,
Yeah, so it's like an everyman president who we don't really know what he did versus people who have like righteous anger about something.
Those Californians, they want their dope free, don't they? I guess, or something like that. Who knows? But yeah, wow. So quite short as a movie, just under 2 hours, I thought. I'm not quite sure how long it worked out to be. Quite a rollercoaster ride, I found.
An interesting soundtrack as well. Sonically, this movie is quite impactful, as you say. Certainly in an IMAX theatre, every assault rifle shot is felt viscerally. But the music is quite amazing too. And there are moments where they drop the sound completely and you see things in silence. It's, yeah, very affecting.
Alex Garland is huge in Hollywood now. But From the Beach, which you pointed out to me earlier before we started recording, he didn't direct, did he? He just wrote.
That's right, yeah. That was Danny Boyle directing.
Danny Boyle. People died in that, didn't they? Central characters. Good and bad. Heroes and anti-heroes and villains too. So what's enervating, I think, about this is Sammy dies. It's not great that Sammy dies, and it's not great that Lee dies. But for Hollywood, I think it's healthy that our band of troubadours don't all survive. I mean, if anything, this movie's about a dose of realism, isn't it? So the fact that only 2 or 4 of them make it out alive, I think, is something, I think, to be applauded. Hollywood's making braver decisions about.
It's certainly not a happy ending, is it? I mean, you
not having happy endings.
You couldn't construe what happened. I mean, okay, so the Western forces overturned apparently somewhat tyrannical president, but they did so by executing him summarily on the floor of the Oval Office. It's not a win for democracy, is it?
No. So, yeah, quite nuanced, I think. But at the same time, he knows how to draw an audience in a popular way, doesn't he? And a really effective communicator, rather like Donald Trump. No, Richard, I didn't mean that. Before I raise your hackles. I don't know. What do you think about it? As a movie.
Yeah, going into this movie, I expected something different. But coming out, I can't have imagined any other way it could have been
done.
What
did you expect?
Bearing in mind that I've spent the last few months completely engrossed in Trump's legal problems. Uh-huh. And not only that, the political situation in the US with Congress being deadlocked and continually having new speakers proposed. And they've just, haven't they? They just passed the bill which gives sort of $60-70 billion to Ukraine, having for a while having that been a real bone of contention in the in the Republican Party, and there's a very strong kind of isolationist streak that's rearing its head in the Republican Party. So I was expecting a more political and partisan take on the breakdown of domestic politics in the US. But yeah, if you'd done that, it would have seemed really small and it would have told a much less interesting story that would have only served its time at best and only served a small section of the population. Whereas really what he's doing is telling a story about war and about civil war in particular, but about war in general, about its futility, its meaninglessness. Also, you know, about journalism, there's some profound things that are said about photojournalism, journalists in the war zone. They all deal with it very differently, don't they? Joel is quite bombastic and into the whole war thing. He gets a kick, doesn't he, about seeing...
Yeah, it's visceral for him, isn't it?
Lee is obviously deeply affected by her past experiences. She says things like, it's our job to document these things so that people know the truth, know what's happening.
Not our job to get affected by them or to care about how we feel about it. Which is a fair point.
But of course, she is badly affected. She's just repressing it all, isn't she? But she also said when she was away covering foreign wars, she thought she was sending images back to, obviously to explain to people, but to change people's
Not only to explain anymore, it's arrived on their doorstep, hasn't it?
Yeah, I guess she realises that was futile. They didn't take the message, did they? Despite everything she showed about the wars that she's seen. They just go and repeat it here. They don't realise what she was really saying with her work.
In 2015, I just finished kind of working in an advertising and marketing company. And my boss was an American guy called Paul from California. And he was saying, I think in 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 years' time, I don't know what he said, the timeline, we're in a bar at the time. He said, America's going to be fractured. It's not going to be the country it is now. And I was like, you're crazy. You're absolutely nuts. And yet what he said was either averagely, randomly, prophetically true, or maybe he had some take on schisms that were starting to affect the US.
What do you think will happen then in the US?
It's a very large country, isn't it? 350 million people, or more than that, 380 now. It grows so quickly, doesn't it? Because, I mean, it's still, despite walls, accepting immigrants, isn't it? Has to be high-calibre immigrants these days, you know?
There can be fewer countries in the world that are more capable of accepting immigrants than the US.
Yeah, I mean, I tend to think in Britain, we laugh at the US unnecessarily. Like, all those videos of Americans not knowing cities in Europe.
Sure.
They're all heavily edited.
Right, yeah.
You know, yeah. I think so many people base their truths on what Americans are like, on those heavily edited and partisan videos that are just there to garner laughs, yeah. And I think there's much that's admirable about the US, to be honest with you. I don't think it is just a melting pot of bikers gone conservative, gone crazy kind of thing, in war camps outside cities, having barbecues and getting women to flash their US flag-clagged titties to them. I mean, it's fascinating to watch on YouTube that aspect of America, because it's such a big country. There are millions of people living in trailer camps. There are all these aspects of America that are completely dysfunctional. But at the same time, I don't think that negates the society as a whole.
No, well said. It is a very big country with a very wide range of circumstances.
Like when you headed to Seattle, did it impress or depress? Because you've been there recently.
No, it impresses. Absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there is that thing about America. It's doing great in a certain sort of way. But are we going to have civil war? Personally, I don't think so.
I don't think so. Listen, Americans are very fond, aren't they? Some Americans, again, anything you say as a generalization is obviously wrong. Some Americans are fond of defending their gun rights and their constitutional right to carry guns, and they make out like it's a mechanism to protect them from tyrannical government.
Yeah, to raise militias if necessary, yeah.
But if that were true, and if people were really up for that, surely if people thought that the election was stolen, that was the time to take up their arms and overthrow the government. If they didn't do it in 2000, they're never going to do it, right? That's never going to happen. So yeah, I don't think we've got a civil war on the cards.
How did you feel about Garland's take here of it? Essentially, was as much action as a zombie movie. Yeah,
it was like a zombie movie.
How does that does that mar, or does that gel well with his cautionary tale about civil war? Do you think, was he glorifying the action? Or did the action add to his, essentially, I mean, it's a fairly simple argument, isn't it? The civil war is damaging and we need to think about how we can all get on with ourselves despite what we consider to be a gulf of very important political positions that stand between us and the other side kind of thing. I think he's trying to implore us to try and get along and hold our political positions, so to speak. But did the action detract from that, or did it hammer the message home more strongly, do you think? Because I don't know.
I don't know either, but all of the violence we see is sort of contextless, isn't it?
Mm.
Perhaps with the exception of the very end. Most of the violence you see seems arbitrary because we have no idea who is fighting for what reason and why.
And in that sense, more horrific, yeah. So maybe it does strengthen his argument. His visual argument about the horrors of civil war.
And even at the end, where I think we're supposed to think the good guys are winning, kind of thing, in a way. It's very shaky. I guess if you're not from Texas or California, you might not feel that way. But even at the very end, they're depicting Washington being attacked, the Lincoln Memorial being blown up, and the White House being attacked by other Americans. Every bit as much as January the 6th is shocking. I think it must have quite a shocking effect. So, although it is action-packed, I don't think it glorifies the violence, does it?
No, I don't think it does. I didn't really know. It was a moot point that I thought, well, let's think about this. And I've kind of come down in favour of the way he did it. You know, I think it's not harrowing, I don't think, violence. That's the point. I never find it particularly harrowing, but it does hammer home a message that this is all quite senseless, isn't it?
Surely.
Yeah.
I think we'd better score this film.
Let's score it.
All right then, Paul. So, I mean, should we start with acting?
Dunn's masterclass in acting here, isn't it? I mean,
she acts the pants off. Well, certainly Jessie, doesn't she?
It's crazy how good she is.
Yeah.
One reviewer said, it's like she's the X-ray to our nation's sickness. She just that will weariness, the PTSD, just how out of sorts she is. It's just so well acted, isn't it?
Very, very good.
So she carries it, I think, her alone. Sam is great as the wise but weary elder.
Stephen McKinley Henderson, of course, who played the Mentat in Dune.
He did, didn't he? That's where this. Okay. I don't know her name, the girl that played Jessie. Sorry, the lady.
Kaylee Spaney? Kaylee? I don't know how
she's probably much older than she looks on screen.
So, on screen, she's like 24 going on 15, 24. Isn't she?
I mean, she's 24 going on 15. She hasn't grown up, has she? So, I mean, just all great. I have to score it 9 simply from Dunst's performance.
Yeah, it is a 9. She really embodies that war journalist kind of persona, doesn't she?
Kate Adie.
Yeah, Kate Adie, yeah. And
younger listeners won't know who Kate Adie is. But
there was that other war journalist, wasn't there? I think she ended up with an eye patch.
Whoa.
I think she might have died in a conflict as well. I can't remember her name, sadly, off the top of my head. But she totally nails the whole persona. Brilliant. So we have to talk plot then, don't we?
Yeah. Just one actor, Jesse Peemans, who you said played the...
Jesse Plemons, yeah.
Why was he not credited for the role?
I don't know, but he was a very late addition to the movie. I know that much.
Really? Interesting. Plot. It's a great role movie, apart from the atrocities that happened along the way. I like the way he plays with role movie tropes. Okay, it's maybe not a movie to be playful with that kind of stuff, but he does it nonetheless and does it well. I thought the action built and crescendoed at the right places. The final scene and the intricacies of getting it into the White House. Wonderful. Supported by a dialogue that, in the quiet moments, in the lulls, focuses on reflection. These journalists trying to get some insight into what they're doing and where they are in life. Yeah, I mean, that's the plot. It worked for me, an 8.
I think that's a fair score, yeah. Mm. I was impressed by what seems like a very tall order, like trying to write something like this. I think it picks really carefully through minefield of potential, like, obvious pitfalls. I'm not sure it hits every note. I'm not sure it totally satisfies. I don't think we'll be watching this at Christmas every year or anything. Maybe we're not supposed to. I'll give it a 7. I'll give it a 7. But it's strong, a strong 7. Categories then, Paul.
I don't really know. I really can't think of anything else.
Action. We could have action and...
Oh, of course we can. We could have
special
action,
effects kind of thing.
Yeah, the action and special effects really hit home. The last 20 to 25 minutes is a roller coaster ride of continuous war zone kind of calamity, isn't it? And how it all pans out. I love the twist there. Sorry, that's going back to plot. The president not being in the car kind of thing. But yeah, the action was very, very convincing. I thought the only bit that I didn't really buy was Sammy arriving in the truck to knock over the two militiamen into the pit.
Without being heard on his approach.
Yeah. I mean, okay, they're in the middle of an argument, but they weren't. The militiaman had them pinned and was listening to their responses, and it was all quiet, wasn't it? So apart from that, which is a small detraction, but I think it didn't really work in the scene. The final scene just really convincing. I've got to go 9 for action too.
The only thing is, modern warfare, modern conflicts, surely, feels like it would be more missiles and...
Wait a minute, this is set in the near future. Where are the drones?
Drones, yeah. Yeah.
Has there been a Butlerian jihad? I don't think so.
That's the only criticism, and I'm not even sure that's a fair criticism.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
I think it more goes to the plot and the writing, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. Yeah.
Perhaps as a consequence of that, though, it's a lot of small-scale conflict, isn't it, quite often? We're seeing
small-arms
skirmishes. Yeah, not big, large-scale events. Even the attack on Washington, D.C., I suppose the idea is...
Yeah, it's not like British war movies where you've got the guy raking the soldiers on the map and then you fade into the battle plan kind of thing.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. I suppose, though, we're supposed to understand that most of the military have already capitulated. Mm. And this is just the last holdouts in the bunker, in the eagle's nest or whatever, isn't it? So, for action, I've got to give it an 8. Yeah. Overall, Paul.
Overall, I've got to go slightly lower than my scores. I'm going to go 8 overall on this.
I'll give it a 7 for overall. I mean, it is a recommend.
If you're going to make a serious movie about Civil War and pitch it ambiguously, I think for the right reasons... At the same time, I don't feel you could leave it to the audience to draw their conclusions about what you're saying. At no point was there any explicit kind of take on what we were watching Civil War for.
Essentially, this is about all civil wars, isn't it?
Yes.
That's the thing. And it's trying to say something about the futility of that activity in a way. But there again, not all civil war really is futile. I mean, can you really say that the American Civil War wasn't a just war for the benefit of the enslaved peoples? And did it not benefit the US to have conducted that conflict?
Interesting.
How about our own civil war?
One man's
defeating
freedom fighter is another man's terrorist, isn't he? Sorry to bring that down to glib generality.
Okay.
What you're saying is no. I mean, there are other objective ways that we could say some freedom fighters... are better than some terrorists. I think you probably can in the large scheme of things. Our Civil War was interesting, isn't it? I mean,
it's part of the history of our democracy, isn't it, to have brought the monarchy to its knees, literally, and chopped its head off. It lays the foundation for parliamentary democracy as we know it, right?
Sure, but were they really doing it to bring a monarch to heel, or were they doing it because of their weirdly devout and cuckoo religious...
Puritanical religious
beliefs. I don't know. History would have to be the judge of that, wouldn't it? You know, I mean, I guess that's the ambiguity maybe he's addressing here. And what I'm saying is, if the monarch had supported their strange and somewhat wacko religious beliefs, would they have had trouble with the monarch? I don't know if they would have or not. It's interesting, isn't it?
I don't know enough about...
how sides are taken.
But I think I am going to learn something about the British Civil War this year.
You're headed off to a Civil War site, aren't you?
Going to Naseby, yes. Yeah.
Well,
you've elected not to bother, as I understand it.
Well, it depends what it is and how it is and how far it is. Okay.
Paul, let us speak of
what did you score this? What did you score this, by the way?
I think I gave it a 7, didn't I?
7, yeah. It's not a classic, but it is really, really good.
It is good. It's worth your time. Now,
we already decided what we're doing because we have one backup.
Yes, we did.
We're going to do that.
And we should watch Oculus, yes. But I should say... The other thing that's also happened is the next Rebel Moon has been released.
On streaming or at the...
On streaming, yeah. On Netflix. We could do Rebel Moon and then do Oculus, maybe. I don't know.
Let's do that. Okay. Let's go Rebel Moon. Let's go Oculus.
Only if you're up for another Rebel Moon.
Yeah, well, I'm glad that we fixed two movies in advance. Let's do that. Let's go for it.
Okay. Next week will be Rebel Moon. And the week after will be Oculus. Super. Thank you for listening this week.
Do join us next time on episode 39.
Goodbye.
Ciao for now. See you on the next one. Bye.